we did a regular beach plastic and litter survey. People would record not only the types of litter, but also the normal brands at the top of it. You see them in all of these things, Coca-Cola and Pepsi. Golden Virginia was one of them, a packet from of tobacco. And actually, the typo was Golden Vagina. And that just made it through every copy sort of edit and into the final print. But, you know, it made a life. I think it made it onto maybe Have I Got News For You or something. And so, so that was good.
Welcome to Communicating Purpose. I'm John Higginson, founder of purpose-led communications agency Higginson Strategy. I believe that the best way to get a message across clearly is by talking about something you honestly and passionately believe in. By doing so, you bring people with you, your passion becomes theirs, and I call this the power of purpose. Today, I'm joined by Hugo Tagholm, the Executive Director and VP of Oceania UK. Oceania is a renowned campaigning organization founded in 2001, dedicated to conserving and restoring the world's oceans. Before his role at Oceania, Hugo co-founded Surfers Against Sewage and acted as its chief executive. Here, he led efforts to stop plastic pollution, running the only marine conservation all-party parliamentary group, the Ocean Conservation APPG, in Parliament. Hugo is an ecologist by training and was awarded the honorary doctorate by the University of Exeter in 2023 for his services to the marine environment. Hugo, it's a great pleasure to have you on the show today. Can you just tell us a bit more about your journey to where you are today?
Thanks. Thanks, John. That's a kind introduction too. Delighted to sort of join you. And in your opening sort of words there, you sort of talked about, of course, the power of purpose and that sort of authentic voice about the things we truly believe in. And that's really what I've used throughout my career as an ocean sort of lover since, you know, my very early childhood as an ocean swimmer, as a surfer, you know, protecting and restoring our seas has just really become such a big passion for me over the decades. And I've had the amazing good fortune to work both in the sort of charity space and the sort of communication sort of PR space around this, and of course leading Surfers Against Sewage for many years, which brought together sort of all of my love to the ocean as an environment to enjoy, protect and interact with regularly. People, because people are fundamental to all of the things we do, and winning hearts and minds, whether it's the people in your community or the people in Parliament or any other sort of decision makers. And then the sort of, the sort of fun of sport and the joy it brings people. I think, you know, where you've got joyful things and that bring people pleasure, people want to protect that too, as well as the environment around it. And so a really great combination of things, probably peppered, of course, with sort of good comms and also sort of innovative sort of relationships around it. SAS and where I am now, as organizations have the ability to sort of bring in interesting celebrities, stakeholders, communications techniques, creative techniques to actually drive a message home. And I'm always interested in breaking out of sort of silos to be even better. So yeah, I'm a surfer. I'm a swimmer. I'm a runner. I also oscillate between London and Cornwall, which I've always done. I live in Cornwall. I've got a lovely office overlooking the sea. We've got humpback whales sort of swimming in front of the office occasionally. I've not seen them yet.
That's amazing having those, isn't it? You know, having those images, seeing those from the coast of humpback whales jumping out of the ocean. I mean, I didn't think I would see that in my lifetime off the coast of the UK. So I think that's really something to be celebrated.
Story of hope. And then in London, of course, I'm a Londoner born and bred actually. And it's an amazing city, of course, diverse sort of views and people, the home of our parliament, you know, where the media is largely sort of based and the creative energy in this is, and of course, I would say this in the greatest city on earth, is amazing and really important to organizations like Oceania to get the things done that we need to do, because a lot of the change that happens ultimately is in Parliament.
Yeah. Well, I really am a super fan, actually, because I remember I've always cared about animals and the environment, but sometimes those kind of, you know, campaigning doesn't feel cool. And I remember in the 90s, Surfers Against Sewage really felt like it was cool and having fun. Obviously, surfing is a cool thing to do. And, you know, bringing together those things. I can't surf, but I'm a keen snowboarder. And I feel
you'll have to come and try at some stage, John.
Yeah, well, I tried once. I just fell off, though, one of those foamy boards. I kind of fell off a lot. But I will try again. And as I say, I feel like there's some similarities, especially culturally, between snowboarding and skating and surfing. So always kind of liked the type of people attracted to surfing. So just tell us, well, you said you kind of mentioned their celebrities and stuff. Tell us about some of those big wins that you had, because, you know, you did really burst into the scene with Surfers in UK waters back when, you know, and it's a huge, huge issue now, isn't it? And it's, but it was really, we didn't know about the sewage going into the ocean.
No, I mean, I think, you know, and people now, you know, now it's, you know, that issue, particularly water quality and the sewage scandal, has become sort of daily sort of headline news, you know, with, you know, maps of where sewage is going out, stories of people getting sick, you know, wild swimmers being exposed to pollution, all of that stuff that has been, you know, powerful through the sort of media lens, you know, but this wasn't always where I think people think it was an overnight thing. And I mean, Fergal Sharkey and others who I worked with closely had a big hand in helping elevate the profile. But, you know, we and in my sort of time, you know, leading Surfers Against Sewage, you know, we pioneered the provision of real-time data, those maps that you see in the papers, the red crosses at beaches, the green ticks when there's no sewage. And, you know, that sort of, you know, almost that sort of wall of sewage, you know, really demonstrated sort of visually, you know, in the papers. That drove a lot of public engagement. But I remember the time when we launched that. It was one beach. It was a beach called Portowan near where my old office used to be. And it was a manual update that my team used to do, my very small team at the time used to do. And people weren't actually that interested then. You know, the media weren't interested. You know, we were breaking this sort of new category. There were even people who had campaigned around sewage in the 1990s. Who felt that there was nothing to see, that the work had been done, and, you know, combined sewer overflows were actually not an issue. And we knew they were an issue. We knew there were tens of thousands of them. We knew they were polluting regularly. You know, we campaigned long and hard for that data. We started creating the number of spots. It was one, then it was two, then it was 10, then it was 50, then it was 100, then it was 300, then it started going into rivers and, you know, all of that. And then suddenly people were interested. And suddenly, as with any campaign or really any marketing thing, you know, you need lots of different touch points for suddenly it to become public currency. And suddenly that happened. We built this real organic sort of momentum. And then, you know, the media, as they did with plastics, were relentless in how they wanted to cover that. And celebrities, you know, certainly started to sort of align around it. It became an example. And it's a sort of quite binary campaigning because, I mean, no one's actually for sewage in the sea or rivers. Everyone's against it. It's a very easy yes or sort of no thing. But it became a great example both of environmental vandalism, but also of corporate exploitation, you know, big business, you know, taking a lot of profit from a private system underpinned by really monopolies, and people were outraged by the financial scandal as much as the sort of environmental scandal. So it's been great to see, and lots of celebrities dived in with it. No pun intended. Both on the coastline, but then also with other sort of allies like Matt Stenyak up in Windermere, and all of the people he had around that. So yeah, it was good to see that trajectory, just as we did on plastics, because plastics was equally as powerful back in 2018. And, you know, we got to work with lots of, you know, great people to break things, you know, and actually quite timely on that. You know, I mean, it's good, you know, the Labour government has just committed to the deposit return scheme in England and Wales. And that's, you know, that's strides forward. And that was built on work that we did back in, you know, 2015, even before that, 2015 to 2018, really.
Yeah, and that's actually, in a way how we met, wasn't it? Because you know Higginson Strategy has really zeroed in on the plastics crisis, and huge number of our clients are anti-plastics NGOs and people in that space. Yep. So it's and I found plastic is a great gateway drug, as it were, to people caring about the environment. My overall concern is nature, biodiversity, climate change, but plastic is something that people can deal with and they can see, and they know that they can actually do something in a way that they struggle with. If you say, we need to reduce CO2 emissions, and they just go, oh my God, it's just too big for me to deal with, and I can't see it.
I agree. I think it's tangible. It's tactile. It touches all parts of our lives. What people were seeing and what people see to this day, on their tide line or on their riverbank or in their park, was actually just a reflection of what they saw on their fast food sort of tables in restaurants or in supermarket aisles or on, in sweet shops. And I think that was pretty shocking for people. And there's been, good things, all of those volunteers that rose up at that time. I mean, there were sort of a couple of real sort of tipping points. I mean, there was a big storm back in, I think, 2013, called Storm Hercules, which put so much plastic on beaches around the southwestern Wales particularly. And that was like a tipping point when suddenly people wanted to start new organizations and sort of movements to tackle it at a community level. And then, of course, we had the Blue Planet effect in 2018. And we were very well prepared for that because we had a range of campaigns on DRS, deposit returns, plastic bags, on beach cleans, on other things. But that moment was really interesting, Blue Planet. I mean, I've said it regularly, and it's only thanks to James Honeyborn, the executive producer of the show, that I sort of know this. And I've done lots of things with him. But out of whatever it was, the 7 hours of broadcasting, only, I think, 14 minutes was dedicated to plastic pollution. And sort of amazing what a powerful bit of communication that was, because people sort of assume that the whole of the thing was about plastics. Now, if you say Blue Planet, you go, that's a plastic sort of documentary. It's the watershed moment on it. But it was such a small part of it. And, what a powerful 14 minutes that triggered all of these things. Governments paying attention, new legislation coming through. Of course, a driver for what we're seeing in the Global Plastics Treaty, whether it's as strong or moving in the direction people really sort of want. I mean, it's still as a result of all of that campaigning from the beachfront right through to Parliament and the UN.
Well, I think that just focusing on that 14 minutes of a much wider show is really important, actually. And if people talk about sales techniques, a really good one is to give people 80% of things that they want that aren't sale, and you only sell to them for 20 minutes. And I think that's one mistake that lots of NGOs make, is that they spend 100% of their communications firing the kind of negative messages at people, and people turn away from that. And Blue Planet's a great example. It was a brilliant, brilliant documentary which showed amazing wildlife, and people watched it for the wildlife, but they came away with that message. And that message was only there for 20% of the time or less, but you still get that message. And I think it's a really good one for communications professionals. Give people positive things that they want to see. And once they're open to that, then you can give them a message they can take away with them. Don't just do it the whole time.
I think that's completely right. And I think it's sort of used in that you encapsulate the challenge of our time, really, in the environmental movement of where I suppose we've got a sort of a culture war sort of building of green versus growth. We've got a challenge of the sector being seen as sort of elitist sort of blockers for things that are happening. So people see our sector often as sort of occupied by people who have everything, who are saying, right, we're going to stop other people from having things. And I think that's a real challenge. And I think we've got to evolve our message into that positive that you mentioned. And it's not necessarily by always just talking about nature. It's about what nature underpins. It's really about future prosperity, jobs for our kids. It's about retaining our society's comfortable place on this planet, because ultimately nature's going to be fine. I mean, it will carry on and go again, you know, whatever happens to us. So this is really about, a battle to ensure we can survive sort of comfortably as we are. So we're not fighting for nature, really. We're just fighting for humankind to be comfortable within nature. So I'm sort of really interested in the language we use and how sort of off-putting it becomes. Some of the things that we take as sort of for granted, we sort of think everyone knows them. But actually, these terms we use, whether it's net zero or, transparency within fisheries or DRS or whatever, it's like to a lot of people, they don't actually know what we're going on about. In today's world, where they're battling just for sort of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, food, water, putting clothes on their kids' backs, all of those things, you're like, okay, we've got to change the language and the sort of framing of sort of what we do, because this is for everyone. It's not just to see humpback whales around the coastline of the UK,
No, well, I think that's a really good point. It is worth explaining those. And net zero, for those that don't know, means trying to get back to zero carbon equivalent emissions. So that's CO2 and methane of 1990 levels. So where we were at in the 1990s in terms of the amount of carbon emitted at that level. And that's what net zero means for those that don't know, but have heard it lots, I'm sure. Tell us about, because you've had some of those great campaigns, any embarrassing moments or failure moments in terms of communications over the years?
Yeah, look, I think there's anyone's career. I mean, I doubt there's anyone out there who doesn't have those moments that still wake them up, late on in their life, in sort of cold sweats about something that happened. And there's a few things that maybe they're helpful for people to hear anyway. I think, and it sounds maybe really simplistic and stupid, like make sure you're well informed when you turn up for like particularly broadcast interviews, but all interviews. I remember one time doing a TV interview around sewage pollution at a beach. I won't name the beach. And it had a combined sewer overflow at that beach that did function relatively frequently, but I had forgotten to locate myself in relation to it, so I didn't actually know where it was on the beach. And so when the journalist said, can we go and have a look, I didn't have that ability. So it was a moment of sort of embarrassment. And of course that was the core bit of information or the core location I should have taken them to. So you think back to those things, and these are a long time ago, and then check things twice if you're putting them into a press release or a bit of communication. We did a regular beach plastic and litter and pollution sort of survey with SAS, and people would record not only the types of litter but also the brands often, and the normal brands at the top of it, you see them in all of these things, Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola, but there'd be other things and interesting things. Golden Virginia was one of them, a packet of tobacco, and actually the typo was Golden Vagina, and that just made it through every copy sort of edit and into the final print, but it made a laugh. I think it made it onto maybe Have I Got News For You or something in the end, so that was good. But so check again, anything that you're putting into the public space, because it needs a few sets of eyes on it before you can be really sure that you've ironed out those kinks.
Check your copy, especially if it's words that one letter change might be extremely embarrassing. That's a very funny.
I mean, I would also sort of say on it, just as a rather than a gaffe, but more a bit of advice, is you only have a small amount of time, normally on any broadcasting. Really know what your key message is that you want to drive home. I mean, there's a lot of, and this is not just for broadcasters, there's a lot of rambling that goes on in interviews. There's a lot of lack of focus. It's the same in PowerPoint presentations, in conferences, too many words. Learn the basics, be well briefed, know what you want to land, and really, really focus in on that.
Absolutely. Good bit of advice. And I just add to that, put a story in there to emphasize what your message is. That's really the best way that people remember, is on stories. Have Absolutely. Some facts in there, but a really good story to back up what you're saying is going to be the thing that people remember
every time.
Let's just talk a bit about your work on Oceana. What's the work involved at the moment? What are you doing?
Yeah, well, look, it's, and I'm really, you know, I'm thrilled to be leading campaigns in the UK and on three areas, oil and gas and stopping new offshore developments. And we had a big win this week alongside our colleagues or our allies at the Uplift Movement, Stop Rosebank Movement, and
massive win, well done.
With the blocking of those leases at the moment, Jackdaw and Rosebank. So really important. I mean, we were a collaborator on that campaign. We've also got our own judicial review coming up to challenge the other sort of 31 licenses that were rushed through by the last government, many of which overlap with marine protected areas. So that's happening in March. Yeah. A really important moment as we, you know, as we continue to accelerate this, you know, what is an unstoppable transition to green energy. And whilst there are detractors out there, you know, this is where the new wealth and prosperity is going to come. This is where regeneration of our coastline and deprived areas are going to come. This is a real example of what can be leveling up, as governments often say, and also help us tackle the most pressing issue in the world, which is climate change. And given there's no public debate or willingness to use less energy, we absolutely need to be fulfilling that energy demand. And so the transition is coming, and we're at the forefront of what I would say is the marine movement on that in the UK, and we've got lots of organizations around us rather than the climate front. So we've got a big alliance called the Ocean Alliance Against Offshore Drilling, and it's putting the positive environmental and economic and jobs case for this transition. So that's good. You know, it's about a better future for everyone with clean green energy, and there are going to be some trade-offs in that, because of course they have, this government is committed to 50 gigawatts of green energy by 2030. It's a lot of installations they have to put in new places, and they're going to have to work out how that operates within and around marine protected areas and other things. We're also working on sustainable fisheries, complicated. The government need to follow the science and data on it again, which is not happening. So fish stocks are, you know, are still often overfished. So we're tackling overfishing, one of the biggest ocean issues out there. Often quite boring for people, sadly. It's more difficult to get across than plastic pollution or water quality issues. It's not going to be a populist issue, but it doesn't mean that it's not as, if not more important. And so I've got a sort of theory. I mean, some things do need a lot of people, but I'm much more interested in minimum viable influence and driving the message home to the right people to create the change. Yeah. And then thirdly, we work on well-managed or well-implemented marine protected areas. We've got 38% of our seas in marine protected areas, but sadly they're not yet properly protected from the most damaging industries, notably bottom trawling and dredging or new oil and gas. And so we need to make sure that happens as we race towards, and to use a, you know, the sort of lexicon of our sector, you know, 30 by 30 and 2030 and the Kunming-Montreal Agreement and all of our commitments around those things, you know, we need to do this properly. They can't just be lines on a map that people assume being protected. So we're doing that. And then I'm responsible for Oceana's outreach around the world at the big ocean moment. So I'm bringing our teams from, you know, from South America and the Philippines and America together for events and sort of advocacy. We're going to be doing at Our Oceans in Korea, the United Nations Ocean Conference out in Nice, in Brazil at the end of the year for the COP30 climate conference. So quite a full agenda, and a really exciting one on what I think are possibly the biggest ocean issues of our times.
Yeah. I'm just going to explain another thing that you said there, 30 by 30. So for listeners, what that means is the UK is committed to 30% of the UK's land mass. I don't know if that covers oceans as well, being...
land and sea, yeah.
Land and sea being given over to nature by 2030. So that's another really big win. And I think it's always worth talking about the positives. One of those positives being the amount of energy in the UK that now comes from renewables, mainly from wind. It's a huge, huge story that we should keep reminding people of, because lots of people out there don't know that. It was only last year that we stopped. There was a full day that when we used no coal whatsoever.
Yeah.
And I think we're probably at around, 50% or more is coming from renewables.
More, I think, now.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an amazing success story. And this is the, You know, I mean, it's got negative and positive connotations. I mean, this is the new sort of industrial revolution in many ways. I mean, this is the cleaner, greener future. This is new jobs, and this is a the thing we need to do to tackle climate change. Of course, there's areas that we can't immediately, avoid in terms of fossil fuels, but powering our homes and powering much of our society, we can. And so it's a great success story, and I'm pleased to be helping move us in the right direction of, you know, ocean positive and nature positive renewables, and making sure we've got a whole new economy that can be built around that, and hopefully places like where I live in Cornwall and the sort of communities that I help represent around the coastline see a whole new regeneration of those communities because of good, highly skilled jobs coming into, you know, harbour, you know, to ports and infrastructure around the country that can really help drive this transition and create jobs from, you know, we know that there's a terminal decline in North Sea oil and gas jobs anyway, you know, irrespective of government policy on renewables. And we know those can, in the long term, be replaced by highly skilled and amazing jobs in the renewable sector. Let's make sure we get this for, you know, done, and get it done for all people.
Yeah. And there's something very circular. I think a lot of people forget, because within all our lifetimes, almost all of our energy has come from fossil fuels. But fossil fuels only really came about as a result of the main fuel being whale oil before yeah. that, and the whales being hunted to almost extinction. And so there's a nice circularity to us seeing yeah. the humpback whales that we're seeing around the UK coast at the moment, which is just, you know, really got people excited about nature, yeah. spotting those. And now, you know, moving on again to another source of energy. We have enough energy, even just from the sun every day being shone on our earth to get all the energy we need. So it's just about moving over.
I think that story is a really nice one. And also I think there's other, it makes me think of the other success stories that we really need to sort of remind people of. And Wales is a good one in terms of the, you know, the 1984 international whaling moratorium, and what that's actually done for recovering, you know, whale populations around the world. And despite the fact it's not, you know, enforced by every country or adopted by every country, Japan and a couple of others being sort of notable, you know, sort of exception. You know, it really has been a success story of multilateralism, good international policy and law and implementation, good enforcement, good public engagement around it. So sort of good on the comms front, good on the political front, and good on the outcomes. And people are inspired by that. Same, you know, and it is slightly different from, of course, climate change and other things, but the same with the sort of the battle on the ozone layer, which was such a prevalent thing in my sort of childhood, and of course a transition away from CFCs, and there were other threats to it now, but there was a replacement for CFCs. Industry knew it, and the world came together to drive that change forward, and it did what it needed to do. So I think there's sort of really great examples of multilateralism, of cooperation and communication, and some of the things that some of the populist movement is moving away from. It's like, actually, we need to work together to challenge these and solve these big crises. And despite some, of course, the tragedy around the world and the sort of soul searching around how it was tackled, the pandemic also did that. It showed how quickly policymakers could come together to drive change. It showed how quickly our governments could mobilize record levels of finance to tackle an issue. It showed how quickly they could bring down barriers to accelerate vaccines and other things. And it showed how the world could work together. Now, maybe they didn't do always the right thing, but they showed that they could move quickly to address an issue. And that's what we're going to need to do, not just on, you know, the environmental issues, but on some of the social issues we face, on some of the, you know, the care issues we face, all of those things. So I think we've got to look at these really positive sort of beacons that can give us the sort of pathway to where we need to get to and how we need to act as a society.
Yeah, I think it's particularly important when countries around the world are moving away from globalization and putting up barriers and talking about trade and immigration being a bad thing, and actually, you know, we should point to those whales that people are seeing and remind people the reason you're seeing those whales there is because the international community came together and, you know, humanity agreed at a global level that we wouldn't kill those majestic animals.
Yep.
And that's why they're there. And it's a reminder so that people can say, this can be done again. Humanity's come together a good couple of times. You mentioned the CFCs in the 1980s that everyone had in their fridges that was causing yep. a hole in the ozone layer, which were banned. That's not a problem that anyone talks about anymore. We don't talk about acid rain and any of those things because it was dealt with.
Exactly that.
Great. And another win that you've had with others last year was the ban of fishing of sand eels in UK yeah. waters.
Yeah, you know, we played, you know, probably more like third or fourth fiddle sort of on that. I mean, we worked alongside the RSPB and Blue Marine Foundation and others on that really, you know, great ban, you know, effectively banning sand eel fishing in the North Sea, both Scottish and English North Sea. You know, sand eels, for those who don't know, the tiny sort of silvery eel-like fish that are there in sort of, you know, significant quantities in our seas and are the sort of base food for some of the animals we know and love most, puffins and seabirds, whales, dolphins and other sea life. So really important. And they're being scooped up often by, you know, Danish and other sort of foreign vessels to feed to pigs to use for other things, you know, to make bacon, I think sometimes to salmon farms as well to make sort of fish meal. I even hear they're sometimes even put in power stations, which seems utterly ridiculous. But you know, the UK government should be applauded on putting that ban in, and we should always make sure we're congratulating policymakers and governments where they're doing the right thing, because if not, they feel they're just on a thankless task and there's little point in them doing anything. And so it's a good thing. And this week, the UK is in the Court of Arbitration because we'll be taken to that court by the EU, because they feel, I think particularly the Danish fishermen feel, that we are breaking the trade and cooperation agreement with that environmental measure. And I hope the government stands strong, and I think they will with this ban. I hope that the outcome will be right, because it's going to be a test of Brexit too. Because if there are, and I just to put my cards on the table, I was not a Brexiteer, and I'm not a Brexiteer, there are benefits environmentally that we can implement because of the freedoms we can protect. We should be able to protect our marine protected areas and sea life. And so if we find that we can't through this, or that the government can't stand up for it, then there's a big question mark even bigger question mark over what is already a big question mark.
Yeah. So, well, there you go. I'm glad you found a positive Brexit story there. And, you know, as you say, we are outside of the EU now. We should be able to make our own laws. Yeah. And it's a real shame that the EU is taking Britain to court, trying to say that fishermen from other countries should be taking sand eels, which are such a keystone, you know, food species for so many different animals and wildlife in UK waters. And I've seen them. We spend a lot of time in Ireland on the beach.
Yeah.
And you see them in these schools right near the surface. And then they're being, you know, and that attracts all the different predators. And you see seals and you see sea bass and all those different predatory fish coming after them. So they're absolutely key, and I hope we can keep that protection for them, because it will make
it's amazing. It's amazing when you see wildlife like that. You know, I often swim in the sea when they're around, and you know, we'll swim through big sort of balls of them, and sometimes, you know, we'll see that what you describe as the sort of the chase, you know, the sea bass and the scad mackerel and others sort of coming through, the mackerel feeding around them. You know, now we're seeing, of course, on that front, the return of tuna fish, bluefin tuna, a lot around the UK. Wow. Amazing shots of them. You know, some, you know, maybe because of water temperature and climate change, maybe because they're coming for other reasons, but certainly another inspirational story, whether or not it's the sort of the protections and rewilding that's brought them back. But they are a sort of a poster fish for people to go, look, sea life is really amazing around the UK, and alongside the humpbacks and the seals and the sand eels, you know, to see these huge fish feeding in great numbers, you know, just off the shore in Cornwall. I've seen them off St Ives, off Falmouth, all over the place, is a spectacle.
Wow. I mentioned earlier some of the clients that Higginson Strategy works with. Are there any that you particularly admire and the way they communicate?
You know, that's a good question. I mean, I've been, you know, I'm always sort of pleased to, you know, where we cross over, John, and, you know, despite it not making it through, the Climate and Nature Bill and the work around that and MPs across the House coming together for it against some quite sort of complicated headwinds internally in Parliament was really good to see. And I was pleased to sort of add my voice to it. And I think some of these things, just so the listeners and the public are clear, you know, they are part of moving the whole story forward. So it's already a win, even if the bill didn't get through. Like, some of the outcomes of it are like a really positive. And I'm always pleased to lend my name and my voice and anything I can do to help to sort of good campaigns that anyone is doing. So I was really pleased to see that. And sort of well done to you and all of the MPs behind it too, Ross Savage and others who really drove it home.
Yeah, and I'll just give a shout out to Zero Hour, who were our client there that brought that forward. And just for listeners, that was a bill that was in the making for about 5 years. It was first being led by Caroline Lucas. The aim of the bill was to make sure that nature and biodiversity sat at the heart of everything the UK does, and really that the UK keeps to its commitments that it's made at international level, like at various COPs and things like that. As Hugo says, it didn't make it through, but it was being carried by Rod Savage, who is a Liberal Democrat backbench MP. In general, bills by backbenchers, even of the party of government, don't get through. But what was really useful is so many MPs backed it. We had over 100 MPs backing it, including from Labour, that the Labour government, Ed Miliband, the Energy Secretary, made a commitment that the government will, on an annual basis, report back to Parliament on what it is doing for nature and biodiversity. And we feel that that will really hold the government to account. It will create news stories every time. The government won't want to be seeing things going backwards. So really big win for Zero Hour and all the MPs, as Hugo said, that were behind that, and the different campaigners also as well that we had there.
Yeah, it was a good piece of work, and yeah, congrats to the Zero Hour team. They were relentless and tenacious in pushing things forward. So well done to them.
What's your favorite form of media?
Yeah, that's a good question. We're so overwhelmed by different platforms these days, but I would say sort of where I feel the most effective sort of, you know, use of my time is, and I'm sort of a big LinkedIn fan. I think there's more organic conversations. There's less toxicity to that space, and you're of course you're there for your professional sort of conversations. You're not sort of surrounded by other agendas. You know, people's holidays or new cars or haircuts you know, cats and dogs, which is great. So I like that. I mean, I'm interested in the transition, you know, between sort of X and Blue Sky and the different sort of takes, because of the owners of platforms and stuff. And I wonder now, you know, what do people really think now that the whole of the sort of tech bro community is with Trump administration? You know, do people want to abandon everything? And I don't think it's helpful for us to silo ourselves into separate platforms. I mean, what world are we going to be in if we only talk to people who agree with us the whole time? What world are we going to be in if we can't be resilient? I mean, I think we've just got to accept that there's some crosswinds. There's going to be a lot of dissent and disagreement. There's going to be some toxicity. I mean, I'll be honest, you know, I don't spend a lot of time looking at comments to everything I write, because, you know, of course people are going to disagree with me. And of course, some people are going to be hostile. So I'll respond to positive, constructive things, but I'm not going to dwell on the people who just want to spit sort of as it were, vitriol or bile in my direction. It's like it's not necessary. So I'm a fan of trying to keep like good constructive sort of debate and engagement. And I'm also conscious, and I'll tell you, and this may be old school, maybe it's not a form of media, but a form of communications. I'm a fan of picking up the phone. I mean, in an age of like of people emailing and making assumptions that they've done their job, or pinging a message off on any platform, it's like if you really want something done, pick up the phone. And like you can get a lot, you know, you can avoid dozens of messages just by picking up the phone. You can avoid, you know, assumptions around what people are thinking, because of course people communicate in different styles. And it's old school, but pick up the phone, have a chat, and ask directly, and often it can cut out a lot of unnecessary work.
Good bit of advice there. Final question: if you could have one dinner with anyone, dead or alive, who would it be, and why?
Oh, you know what? This will change all the time. This will change all the time, and I could pick a celebrity or a famous sort of influence, but I'm going to pick today my great aunt Margaret. And she was an incredible, incredibly balanced and wise person who used to offer me all sorts of insights about what I should do. She's no longer with us. She died many, many years ago. But she was just very, very measured and considered with everything she did. And I often think about that in terms of how I try to be.
Hugo Tegholm, Executive Director and Vice President of Oceania UK. You've been speaking to me, John Higginson, on Communicating Purpose.